Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Dave Schlossberg, pianist, arranger, and composer, on his CD MP3, A Place Beyond Words, New Visions of Classic Jewish Melodies. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinchinim, Chen Dinachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking a great deal lately about the ubiquity of Jewish shows and themes in popular culture now, particularly on TV. It's evident we are now living in the golden age of Jewish-themed shows on TV, or at least many excellent comedies and dramas that deal openly with important Jewish cultural, religious, historical, and ideological issues. Many of those shows are streamed on Netflix or Amazon, but others are on over-the-air channels. From the long-running Curb Your Enthusiasm to the outstanding new The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel to the fine, funny, underappreciated show Red Oaks to the much-celebrated The Man in the High Castle and on to the profane but hysterical Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, TV viewing today provides a wealth of the best Jewish shows ever broadcast. Frankly, it's a great time to be making a Jewish show or just watching one. It used to be we'd see a Jewish episode on a popular show and get all excited. Wow, there's a Jewish wedding scene, or somebody talked about a bar mitzvah, or sang a Hanukkah song. That's because up until about 1970 or so, there were lots of Jewish writers, directors, actors, producers, TV and movie studio heads, but there were very few openly Jewish themes in popular culture. For a while, back in the early days of movies, Yiddish language features and more general releases like The Jazz Singer played to specifically Jewish audiences. The Marx Brothers made Jewish-flavored vaudeville films, and that was about it. Then, after World War II, there were a couple of fine movies about anti-Semitism in America, like Crossfire or Gentleman's Agreement, and eventually some Holocaust films, The Diary of Anne Frank and Judgment at Nuremberg. But until about 1970, in spite of the ubiquity of important Jews throughout the entertainment industry, heck, you could say we invented it in America, Jewish shows and themes were few and far between. Every once in a great while, a Fiddler on the Roof would come out and Jews all over America would go nuts. And everyone who was alive and watching TV back then remembers Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows as a high watermark for TV comedy, made and performed by lots of Jews, but not really about Judaism. But that kind of exception really proved the rule. You didn't find much of anything in the general media that was, well, too Jewish. That began to change in the late 60s and 70s. More films with Jewish themes and identifiably Jewish characters appeared, like the movie version of Philip Roth's Goodbye Columbus in 1969, and Jewish-flavored comedies by filmmakers Mel Brooks and Woody Allen started showing up regularly. Television became the central entertainment medium, and it included a few more Jewish elements over time. Intermarriage was the theme of the ill-conceived series Bridget Loves Bernie in 1972, and otherwise there were specifically Jewish characters on popular TV shows, even if their Judaism wasn't specifically mentioned, Rhoda on The Mary Tyler Moore Show or Fish on Barney Miller. The 80s gave us a star of 30-something trying to hang on to his Judaism. The 90s added more Jewish characters who weren't very Jewish, like Paul Reiser's character in Mad About You, Dr. Joel Fleischman on Northern Exposure, and two out of the six friends in that titled show, Fran Drescher's The Nanny. And, well, you know, everybody nearly on Seinfeld was Jewish, but they never really discussed Judaism. Occasionally, you'd see an actively Jewish character like Fivish Finkel on Picket Fences, but generally speaking, while Jews with Jewish last names showed up more as characters, there weren't a whole lot of really Jewish themes. In fact, when on the hit show Will and Grace, Grace married a Jewish guy in 1998, it marked the very first time two Jewish characters ever got married in a popular TV show. That took, like, what, 50 years from the start of televised programming? The 2000s began to change this. In Sex and the City, a principal character, Charlotte, converted to Judaism to marry Harry, and Larry David's incorrigible Curb Your Enthusiasm often had openly Jewish issues and events, as did Glee at the end of the decade. Animated programs had Jewish characters, too, for many years. Krusty the Clown on The Simpsons or South Park's Kyle, both notably Jewish. Still, for all of this progress, the current blooming of five different very Jewish TV shows, all running successfully at the same time, is unprecedented in American popular culture. It means a couple of things. One, there sure are a lot more ways to get shows out to the public today, with the abundance of TV channels, streaming, and online stuff available. And two, Jews are now making TV shows and movies with openly Jewish themes and characters. In this way alone, our acceptance in American society, in fact, you could make a case for our centrality in American culture, has never been more evident. To play us in this morning, here's a setting from our guest, Dave Schlossberg, his jazzy version of the classic melody for Yadid Nefesh. That was our guest this morning, Dave Schlossberg's version of Yadid Nefesh. Dave Schlossberg's a pianist, arranger, and composer. He has a new CD MP3 out called A Place Beyond Words, New Visions of Classic Jewish Melodies. He's a wonderful way of infusing his own musical sensibilities into familiar tunes, making them something new. Find out how he does it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
To welcome back our guest this morning, here's a bit of his own, Vishamru.
Thank you.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Dave Schlossberg, is a pianist, arranger, and composer. He has a new album out. We've actually played a cut or two already on Two Jewish called A Place Beyond Words, New Visions of Classic Jewish Melodies. His own pianistic take on a variety of Jewish music. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So I'm going to start with a not exactly an off-the-topic question, but to you, what is Jewish music?
What a question. Well, to me, Jewish music is, it's my life. I mean, that's first and foremost.
That's a good start. We like that.
Yeah. Jewish music has a quality about it that's really hard to define. It seems, in my estimation, to have a certain beauty, a certain longing quality to it that is not often found in other music, in my opinion. And playing Jewish music, for me, is the fullest expression of who I am as a musician and as a person. I feel that Jewish music on its own is very beautiful, very diverse, and it offers a great opportunity for connection in any of its forms. I mean, whether you're talking about classical style pieces or folk music or Jewish a cappella, I feel they all offer something, and it really helps forge that connection to God in whatever manner the music is. It's got that tom, that taste to it, that quality that I find personally so appealing, and it's why I've decided to devote my life to it.
Your album, in the choices you make, you use many melodies that will be familiar to people who have attended synagogue, who have an experience of Jewish music, and yet you reinterpret them. Was it a conscious choice not to take, more pop-oriented original melodies?
Yes. I found that the music I chose was, it kind of towed the line between being, in my mind, very beautiful, but also recognizable. But I like music that's understated. I don't like music that's overdone. I mean, not that I don't like it, but when it comes to what I play, I prefer material that hasn't been done to death. So a new take on it would be refreshing, and that's kind of what I'm going for.
Well, you know, the Haftorah blessings have been done a few times, but your interpretation is really quite unique.
Thank you. Well, regarding the Haftorah blessings, I come at them from a musical perspective. I hear them every so often at services, and I'm struck by how different they are from Torah trope. And, you know, in my mind, I hear this orchestra that's playing these harmonies that aren't really there. The Haftorah trope is chanted, and I hear all this potential. And so, even if it has been done before, I know that because it's just the same couple of notes in different configurations, that there really is a great variety of direction that you can take artistically. So I tried to make it as unique and as provocative as I could.
We will continue in just a few moments with our guest talking Jewish music with pianist Dave Schlossberg. New album is called A Place Beyond Words. When we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You returned recently from a trip to the former Yugoslavia, which had a remarkable and interesting Jewish community. As you mentioned, the part that had been under Ottoman was Sephardic. The part that had been under the Austro-Hungarian Empire was Ashkenazic. And Belgrade, you sort of had both. Many magnificent synagogues were constructed when it was a large Jewish population. Tell us sort of what still exists there.
Well, in particular, there's a region called the Vojvodina, which is a semi-autonomous, blah, 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 part of Serbia. And even in the days of the former Yugoslavia, it was still a semi-autonomous region because it was the southeasternmost part of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the language of most Jews there was Hungarian, not Serbian. All the cities have names that are both Serbian and Hungarian. And Hungarian is still a popular minority language, although less and less so after all the years of Tito and all the conflicts among and between the countries of Eastern Europe. It's probably more Serbian than at any point in its history, ironically. But there in particular, there are cities like Novi Sad, which is Ujvidek in Hungarian and is the capital of the Vojvodina, and Subotica in the extreme northeast that have absolutely gorgeous synagogues. I think the Subotica synagogue is maybe the second largest in Europe.
Wow.
Now, the Jewish communities that survive in these places are so tiny that they could never fill these synagogues, which have been restituted to the Jewish communities, which in some cases can't afford even their upkeep.
Upkeep, yeah.
Or the heating. So in one case, they rent it out as a place for local theater groups, and they have a smaller place where they gather to celebrate Jewish holidays, et cetera, et cetera.
Look, last year I was at the Dohain Synagogue for Shabbat in Budapest, a large and successful Jewish community, and they didn't heat the main sanctuary and used a separate building.
Right. So, and that's a big Jewish community.
Big Jewish
the
community.
The ones we're talking about now
Jews.
Are tiny. But
right.
what strikes me with increasing force, actually, as I get older, is how interconnected all these Jewish communities are in the former Yugoslavia, in the sense that, so my friend's son met me in Singapore once and introduced me to a guy who was teaching at the National Management University. The young man's name was Uroš, early 30s, brilliant guy, a Jew from Novi Sad, who got married like 18 months ago in Subotica because the synagogue is so beautiful. And he came to have dinner with my friend's son and me and another guy, all Jewish to one degree or another, and talking about how to reinvigorate Jewish communal life in the former Yugoslavia. And I said, you know, it strikes me that the three of you guys from different backgrounds and different places just getting here to talk about this is kind of proof that it's pretty vigorous as it is. It's not as bad off as you think. And a very lively debate ensued, which was well washed down with lots of Schlivovitz and other drinks, local products, shall we say, local specialties.
Local specialties. Tom, very interesting visit to the Jewish communities of the former Yugoslavia. Still some vitality and a lot to see and participate in. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So we're going to talk about your favorite subject, corruption in Israel. Now, I'm going to start by saying, in a recent study of the Middle East, in terms of transparency, how not corrupt societies are, Israel is by far the least corrupt society in the Middle East by a huge margin. But that is damning by faint praise, as we say, because the Middle East is wildly corrupt in every other
society. Do we want to be Zanav la Rayot or Rosh la Shualim or what?
Or do we want to be an Or la Goyim here? It's not exactly the greatest situation, and there have been major protests in Israel about corruption.
Yes.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yes, I'm definitely, as an Israeli, I'm definitely embarrassed from, you know, the reality right now, but I'm also very proud in terms of how the Rehova Israeli, how the, you know,
the Jew on the street, the man on the street,
the woman on the street. Definitely. Yeah. The way, like, we're not tolerant about, you know, corruption in our society, and no one is protected, you know, by the law. You know, if with the
no
risk,
one's above the law, we say.
No one above
well,
the law.
Well, if Ehud Olmert could go to prison for a long time when he was prime minister.
And he's, unfortunately, he's not the only one.
No.
We,
no.
we can dedicate like a whole...
You know, it's,
anyway,
in California, we had a place in Lompoc that they used to call Club Fed because it was the fancy prison for all the white-collar criminals who had done bad things. In Israel, you would need that just for the politicians.
Yeah, that's definitely sad. And, you know, in these days, we are trying to... And there is a show right now on the Israeli TV about Begin because we really want to kind of go back and look how our leaders were before and how modest and transparent and really the nation and the Jewish people, the Israel people was above all, you know. And there
was wasn't that partly because Israel was really poor? There wasn't a lot of money to take.
That's also true. That's also true. But, you know, it was like one anecdote that stays with me when Begin asked Aliza, buy me 5 white shirts and take the receipt for it. And, you know, and then Aliza said to him, you know, since you're going to use it only after office hour, you know, it won't be like it will be considered as a private.
A private purchase.
Yes. So, you know, just, you know, what, 40 years ago, not 3,000 years ago.
Yeah, not even.
So I agree with you. Everyone were poor, so there is no one to steal from. But we lost a little bit...
the idealism of...
Nachon.
Yeah. You know, I think about it. I remember when I was in Israel for the first time during Rabin's first... Maybe my second time there, Rabin's first prime ministership, and he had to leave office because his wife had an offshore account. It wasn't that they were stealing money, but when they traveled, they had money in a bank in Cyprus, and it was against the law. He couldn't do it. And that was, you know, illicit. Considered by the Israeli public at the time. Now it seems...
And again, it wasn't long ago.
Right.
And it's like it's dramatically changed. You know, you see... It's unfortunate that you see corruption really across all the different mixerim. You know, rabbis that have been accused for corruption... like Arya Deri and others from
Shas. Right, no. And rabbis not involved in politics.
And Sarim.
People selling conversions like, and so on.
Yeah.
It's not what we want to see.
Yeah, mamash.
The good part is it's being held up in the light of day and prosecuted pretty vigorously.
And the Israel street, as we say, there is a lot of demonstrations every week, almost every day. So we're not letting this... You know, even it was like in Elat last week was a Likudiada party. People were on the street and really demonstrating against tax money been used. Excuse me?
Against corruption and against misuse of funds. Well, we hope it continues to clean up. Thanks so much, Ashrat.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe Goldberg was hit by a car and taken to the Catholic hospital. He became friends with a nun who was a nurse. One day, she came into his room and saw that the crucifix on the wall was missing. She asked him, Abe, what did you do with the crucifix? Oh, sister, Abe replied, I figured one suffering Jew in this room was plenty. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Asu li mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham. Make me a sanctuary and I will dwell among them, God commands in this week's Torah portion of Truma. And the sanctuary ordained is for the purpose of ritual animal sacrifice. Defunct in Jewish tradition for over 1,900 years since the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70, just what can ritual sacrifice teach us in the year 2018? One of the central teachings of Judaism, one of our great and most influential revelations, is that God does not require human sacrifice of us. From the time of the binding of Isaac, the Akedah, we read on Rosh Hashanah, to the creation of the tabernacle in the wilderness of Sinai that's at the heart of our Torah portion of Truma this week, Judaism repeatedly affirmed that children are not bred to be sacrificed to an angry or vengeful God. Instead, sacrifice is ritualized into animals, used to supplant the dangerous pagan tendency to kill human beings. Described in loving detail in this week's portion, at the heart of biblical Judaism is the altar for the sacrifice of small animals, cakes of grain, and incense, not humans. It is never to be used, as other religions might have, for the real or surrogate sacrifice of even a single person. This may seem obvious, but I think for most of us today it's not. You see, the Mizbeach and the Mishkan, the altar of sacrifice of the tabernacle in the wilderness, was a means to an end. It served as a way for our Israelite ancestors to sublimate the apparent human need for ritual and rite. It gave them an understanding of the value of human life. Our high priests, indeed all Kohanim, were taught to be Ohev Shalom Verodev Shalom, lovers and pursuers of peace. They did not engage in punishing human beings or even participate in warfare or policing. They were trained solely in ritual, including ritual sacrifice. To our eyes, the sacrifice of an animal may seem barbaric, and to the vegetarians among us, it probably should, but biblically it was used to demonstrate that God loved and valued human life in this world and did not desire its destruction. The mitzvot, the commandments, were ordained for the purpose of life. V'chai bahem, we were commanded, live by them, not die for them. Human sacrifice was ubiquitous in the ancient world. You can even make a case that Christianity was a way of reaffirming that ancient practice, ritualizing in a highly graphic way a literal human sacrifice, the killing of God's own son. That soon became a way of asserting the primacy of the world to come over life here in this world. While giving full respect to the profound ethical basis of Christianity and its sincerity of belief, Judaism went down a different path that insisted that the giving of human life is no desirable end, no bargain, no metziah. While we mourn and remember our many martyrs, we celebrate their lives and their courage, not the brutal way they ended. For Jews, the true passion is for life, not death. The purpose of religious expression of Avodah worship is to reach towards that passion, to affirm God's connection to us in a direct and holy way while we are here. In our tradition, prayer and tzedakah replaced ritual sacrifice. It's not blood that God seeks now, but our own passionate devotion to holiness, to personal and professional morality, to social action, to the good we can bring in this world. Poet Ruth Brin wrote about the process of sacrifice as conducted by the high priest then and by us today. The garments of the high priest were of such beauty, the jewels so radiant they dazzled the people. Daily in the sanctuary he made sacrifices to the Lord of the lamb and the bull, the dove and the little cakes. To the shepherds and farmers who brought the sacrifices, these were the means of life. Thus they proclaimed their willingness to give life itself to their God. In all ages, at all times, people have traded value for value. But for those who love God, the only sufficient gift is the symbol of life. Teach us, God, the spirit of sacrifice. Accept as sufficient our prayers and our attempts to pray as you once accepted the lambs and grain of our ancestors. Will you accept our struggling efforts to return love for hostility, justice for partiality? Will you find our study acceptable? Teach us, God, the spirit of sacrifice, how to devote our lives to our highest ideals. In this week, when we read Parshat Truma, may our own religious direction, our prayers, actions, and spirits be nurtured by our connection with Jewish holiness and blessing. May we continually affirm life as Judaism and God ask. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Dave Schlossberg, will discuss how he finds musical inspiration in classic Jewish melodies and makes them new and interesting. Hear from him when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
An Israeli man was stabbed to death last week outside the Jewish West Bank city of Ariel. The terrorist behind the stabbing was identified as an Israeli Arab from Jaffa. The manhunt for the 19-year-old is still ongoing. The murdered man, Rabbi Itamar Ben-Gal, 29 years old, was treated by civilian medics and military medical personnel. then evacuated to a hospital where he succumbed to his wounds. Ben-Gal was a father of four from Har Bracha, a Jerusalem area settlement. He was a teacher at religious seminaries. In a video of the attack, the assailant gets out of a taxi van, crosses the road, and stabs Ben-Gal, who was waiting for a bus. He then tried to flee from his attacker, but the assailant threw his bag on the road and chased his victim until he killed him. A spokesperson for the IDF said that a terrorist came to the hitchhiking stop at the entrance to Ariel and stabbed a civilian. An Israeli officer identified the assailant, pursued him with his vehicle, and struck him. The assailant fled. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu sent his condolences to the family. Following up on a similar incident of Palestinian terrorism, Ahmed Nasser Jarer, head Palestinian terror cell operative responsible for the January murder of Rabbi Raziel Shevach, was killed by Israeli security forces early in a raid last week in the West Bank village of Yamun near Jenin. Clashes erupted in the village between dozens of Palestinians and Israeli forces after the raid. Two Palestinians were wounded by rubber bullets, while seven Palestinians were hurt from tear gas inhalation. Jarer's house was surrounded by Israeli security forces. When he emerged with an M16 rifle, he was shot to death. Jarer headed the terror attack that killed Shevach on the main Highway 60 near the West Bank city of Nablus last month.
I'm sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand, and every stop is neatly planned for a poet and a one-man band. Homeward bound, I wish I was. Thoughts escaping home, where my music's playing home, where my love lies waiting silently for.
Paul Simon says he's going to stop touring, save for the occasional performance for charity. I've often wondered what it would feel like to reach the point where I'd consider bringing my performing career to a natural end. Now I know. Feels a little unsettling, a touch exhilarating, and something of a relief, the beloved Jewish singer-songwriter said.
Can you imagine us years from today, sharing a park bench quietly? How terribly strange to be 70. Old friends, memory brushes the same years, silently sharing the same
Paul Simon himself is now 76 years old and noted that the death of his longtime guitarist, Vincent Nguini, last year contributed to this decision, along with the amount of time he spends away from his family during a tour. His upcoming Homeward Bound tour, which will span nearly 30 dates across the U.S. and Europe, will be his last. Get your tickets soon.
Looking good, boys.
I know.
Let's do this.
Come on.
A rabbi, a priest, an imam, and a Buddhist monk get into a Toyota truck and go to a football game. Instead of the opening line to a joke, that was the most heartwarming commercial that aired during the Super Bowl last Sunday. In the ad, a rabbi rushes out of a synagogue and into his Toyota pickup, stops to pick up a Catholic priest, an imam, and then a Buddhist monk. The four are friends and tease each other on the way to the game. When they get there, the rabbi puts on a kippah and the team's colors. Group members take their seats. They're scolded by two nuns for being late. The ad is captioned, "We're all one team," as the religious leaders cheer a touchdown run. Not a bad way to spend, $10 million for a 60-second message with a good theme. Thank you, Toyota. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. To welcome back our guest, here's a little of his setting of Mizmor LeDavid.
Thank you.
We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Dave Schlossberg, is a pianist, arranger, composer, and has recorded a new album. It's called A Place Beyond Words, New Versions of Classic Jewish Melodies. It was selected as one of the top five albums in the fall of last year by the Global Music Awards competition. And he also received a silver medal for outstanding achievement. You know, when you play, as opposed to when you're conducting or working with choirs, playing in a synagogue setting, when you play on your own, is it a different experience for you?
Yeah, it is. I find that when I play on my own, I'm really only beholden to my own imagination. And when I'm in a synagogue setting or any other concert setting, I'm often given constraints. And I wouldn't so much say they limit me, but I am kind of forced to go in a certain direction. And I enjoy playing on my own because it gives me the freedom to explore both harmonically, rhythmically, even melodically, things that I probably wouldn't dare to try on a larger stage. I just happen to be in a synagogue that really fosters my creativity and lets me, quote unquote, go all out. So I really enjoy that opportunity every week. I kind of try and make something fresh or make something new. And the way I play, it's really never the same way twice. And so I enjoy how refreshing it is for me too, personally, listening to myself and knowing that not only do I have artistic freedom and artistic control, but then I'm often surprised and delighted by the stuff I can come up with. Not all the time, but, you know, enough to make it interesting.
Look, nobody's great all the time.
Absolutely not, right.
I want to note something that's sort of important, I think, for our listeners, which is there is a difference between doing Jewish music in a conservative and a Reform synagogue setting. Speaking as a conservative cantor and Reform rabbi, I have a little experience with this personally. Tell us about the differences that you experience.
Well, the differences that I experience are, when you're doing music in a Reform setting, there's a heavy emphasis on music as not only an aid to worship, but as vital to worship. There's this sense of, you know, you can't really pray without musical background. And for me, you know, that's always been right up my alley, so to speak. However, in some other traditions, it's not as important, and maybe for some people, they don't even use it. Now, I certainly understand that people have there are many different ways to reach to God, and I, of course, respect that. I'm just happy that that my chosen profession and the place where I work, they know who I am as a musician, and they encourage me to grow and challenge me. But yeah, in Orthodox and conservative shuls, it is very different, and you know I have gone to my share of services when I can, and you know I've seen the differences, and you know there are, as I said, many ways to connect to God. I just happen to enjoy the opportunities that the Reform music movement offers for me.
So I'm going to follow up on that, because the melodies that you selected, I mean, not just say Ve'ahavta, but the melodies that you selected to work with, most of them are really not from what people in the Reform movement would call contemporary Reform music, from Shlomo Carlbach to the other composers. Many of these are folk melodies. I think there's only one or two that really would fall into the Reform category, and yet they become fresh with a new interpretation that might not be so available in a more traditional setting. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. So I did choose a lot of music based on the idea that I wanted every Jew who purchased my album to find something that they recognized or something that they grew up with, perhaps. I didn't want to make it confined to one vision of Jewish music, because I really believe in my heart that this beauty that I see in Jewish music is found in all Jewish music. And, you know, even the traditional chants of our holy texts, like the Ve'ahavta and the Haftarah blessings, I feel... And by the way, traditional, you know, doesn't mean... I don't really know how far back they go.
Right, we call them Mi-Sinai tunes, as though they came from Mount Sinai. But even the oldest of the melodies we know, we can't date before the Middle Ages, I don't think.
Right, right. And so even with those tunes, I feel like there's this beauty in them just waiting to come out. And I've found that when you sit down at the piano and really explore this music, you find that there are really infinite directions that you can take. And so the music that I chose was deliberate as kind of a trying to demonstrate the depth of Jewish music across all denominations. And I chose it because not only a combination of the fact that the songs are, you know, well known for the most part, but also that they are songs that you might not think would have or should have accompaniment. And so I kind of like to play with that idea because I feel like if a song is a cappella, you know, there really is an accompaniment going on, you know, in the human heart or in your mind or something under it that fulfills or fills the music, even when it's a cappella or chanting. And I felt, you know, I don't want to be cliche or trite and say, you know, the music is in you all along, but I do feel like there's an element within every person of you know, striving towards, striving to give music to, you know, to whatever they hear and to kind of make it, to connect themselves to it and to have their own little internal orchestra, I guess you could say, that accompanies it. So I tried to access that in my choices of the music on my CD.
All right, so I have to ask this question. I've always wondered about this tremendous popularity of a cappella music. You're a pianist. How does that make you feel?
Oh, I certainly I love to spread the wealth. I mean, I never had a problem with a cappella music or, you know, any type of music, although I will say that, you know, rap and country music, I could take it or leave it. Some of it's good, but you know, in terms of a cappella music, I always was a fan of the human voice as an instrument of expression, and you know, for that reason, I am a member of many choirs as an accompanist. I accompany many choirs. I serve as music director for a bunch more, and you know, I guess sometimes I even sing when I'm asked to, but usually when I'm at a choir rehearsal, I am behind the piano. But what I'm trying to say is that I have developed a healthy respect for the human voice and, you know, its potential and the harmonies that we can reach. And so, you know, as a professional musician, I say when it comes to a cappella music, you know, the more the better. And I've arranged several songs for a cappella. For example, I did an arrangement of Ma'oz Tzur for soprano, alto, tenor, bass, SATB, as they say. And, you know, it was the kind of thing that was very fulfilling for me because you took the Ma'oz Tzur that we all know, Ma'oz Tzur Yeshuati, and I just gave it, you know, a whole different treatment by adding jazz harmonies and, you know, I put some Lewandowski in there as well. You know, I kind of made it my own. And so I really do have a healthy respect for what the human voice can do, both on its own and as combined with the piano.
All right, so I'm going to ask a difficult question. What's your favorite cut on your new album?
Well, my favorite cut is probably the Ve'ahavta. That's track number 3. And I'll tell you why I like it. I like it because I think it really represents the truest expression of my musical process. The story behind it is very interesting. So years ago, well, by years, I mean I'm only 34, so let's just say 2 years ago.
A mere child.
A mere child. When I was a little younger, I was asked to accompany Shacharit services at, those were morning services, at the Guild of Temple Musicians Convention in Philadelphia.
So no stress, no pressure.
No pressure. I had done it a couple of times before, or, you know, leading services, but not on such a big stage. And I knew that those who would be at the service were, you know, Guild of Temple Musicians members. So they were all temple musicians, or, you know, or cantors, or, I mean, and cantors. Some of them, some cantors are Guild of Temple Musicians members. But in short, they'd all be musical people, and so I had to be on my A game. So anyway, the story behind the Ve'ahavta was that during rehearsal, the service leaders, they had, who were both cantors, by the way, they had a set list of all the songs that and the musical selections for the different prayers. And, you know, we went through them in order. And when we got to the Ve'ahavta, they were like, okay, this is a cappella, and, right, you know, we'll move on. And then all of a sudden, I had this thought in my head. I'm like, wait a minute, you know, this might be my chance to kind of accompany it with chords under it. And, you know, we talked about it, and they said, well, we're not sure. We may ask you to do that, but they said that it was a risk because everyone knows it as, you know, an a cappella Torah trope
chant of trope. Yeah, of course.
Right. So the last thing I want to do was to make anyone uncomfortable or to alienate anyone or to make people feel like I'm stepping on their prayer or whatever. I was kind of nervous to do so. So anyway, the service comes, and during the Ve'ahavta portion, the guy, the cantor up there, his name is Ted LeBeau, he said, okay, and now we'll continue with the Ve'ahavta, and Dave Schlossberg will provide some accompaniment. And I thought to myself, uh-oh. I guess he decided to do it.
Better be ready.
That's right. So I figured out what key everyone was in, and I just decided to play what I thought were appropriate chords for the moment. And, you know, I did the rest of the service as normal, and afterwards, I had people coming up to me more than once saying how moved they were, how affected they were in a positive way by my rendition of Ve'ahavta. And I was very shocked. I thought that, you know, it's nothing different from what I kind of always do at, you know, Anshe Emeth in New Brunswick, New Jersey, where I work. Not that I do the Ve'ahavta accompanied there, but, you know, my pianistic style, I just, you know, that's kind of what I do. And so I was really almost floored that people showed such an appreciation of it, and it was for that reason that this album, you know, happened, because I thought, oh, wow, there really is a future in you know, playing my improvisations and my arrangements of Jewish liturgical music. I mean, there is an audience. And so with the Ve'ahavta, you know, it's two things, really. Number one, I really like the story behind it, but also it's really truly, like I said, an expression of my creative process. I mean, I do a lot of exploration with harmony, with different styles of playing. In the middle, there's what I'd like to think of as a Vince Guaraldi type section. And, you know, it really captures kind of my essence, even down to the modal style of playing. And, you know, I mean, modal is, it's a musical term which I really don't know how to define, but,
well,
you know,
you could call it nusach if you wanted to be...
You could. So in any sense, I've always found Torah trope in particular, because I hear it every week, or, yeah, I do. Well, sometimes chanted less musically than others.
Of course.
But I do hear it every week, and so I've always thought that, boy, there's really such good stuff in there, and the Ve'ahavta was my way of accessing that.
I want to ask one final question, a quick one. There's been a trend in the Reform movement for music to go all the way through the service. In other words, everything's accompanied except perhaps the sermon. maybe not the Torah chanting if the Torah is chanted. That's a newish thing in the last 10 or 15 years. I assume that you like that. Talk about what that has meant to the kind of feel of prayer.
Well, when you have music all throughout the service, I'm kind of two minds about it, because I really do like the idea of having a free flow through the service. I think that it really adds, you know, you never want to break somebody's concentration, and there's nothing worse than, you know, when there's a stumble of some type and you know everyone kind of knows that it's all a show, you know, and that you know, they lose it. And once you lose whatever it is, whatever you're focusing on, whatever you're praying for or praying about, it becomes really hard to get it back. So in that sense, I do love the idea of having flow. And I do also think that as a musician, it's a great opportunity for me, because there is a lot of great stuff you can do to connect songs and portions of the service. Now, on the other hand, I do value silence as well. There was a little paragraph that was in the siddur that I used for years, and it was during the silent prayer, and it was a little mini story, and you read it while you were reading, while you were praying silently. And it was a little mini story, and the gist of it was that a great pianist was asked, how do you handle the notes as well as you do? And the pianist answered that, you know, I handle the notes no better than many musicians, but the pauses between the notes is where the art is. And so that always stuck with me. And so what I'm trying to get at is that I do feel like silence and, you know, a break and letting people take a breath is also important. I feel that, you know, you really, that prayer should not be forced and should not be something that you have no control over, but rather something that grows organically. And I feel, so you can see how I'm of two minds about it. I mean, as a professional musician, I enjoy the musical opportunities that music throughout the service offers, but as a as a Jew who prays, I feel like sometimes silence is the best type of music.
I want to thank Dave Schlossberg for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His album is called A Place Beyond Words, New Visions of Classic Jewish Melodies. Where can people go to find out more about you?
So you can go to my website, www.daveschlossberg.com. That's daveschlossberg.com. And you can also visit me. I have a YouTube channel, and I'm also on Facebook. And you can find some of my music there, and some of my compositions, as well as some of my sheet music and arrangements on my website. And I'm trying to get a larger web presence. So be on the lookout, because I'll be definitely somebody who you'll be hearing more from in the future.
Thanks so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical playout from Dave Schlossberg.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Ruchama Feuermann, author of The Rebbetzin's Courtyard, a wonderful follow-up audiobook to her debut novel In the Courtyard of the Kabbalist. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes, top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from our guest, Dave Schlossberg, his version of the Torah classic, Be'an Arachetz. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.